Okay. Well, the speaker today is Tom Gilchrist, who's going to be presenting on populism. He's an activist out in Adelaide and a member of Socialist Alternatives. So he's going to speak for about 30 minutes, and then we can have time for discussion afterwards.
Cool.
So populism has become one of the most commonly used words to describe current developments in global politics. So there was a recent report that the word was used no less than a million times in the years 2014 to 2016 in journalistic publications. You know, last year it was the Cambridge Word of the Year in recognition of its widespread usage. You know, and over the last several years, it's been attached to, you know, a really enormous number of right-wing, left-wing, or even, you know, centre movements. You know, the two most prominent being, you know, the Leave vote in the Brexit referendum and the election of Donald Trump. But, you know, if you can list off some of the ones from, you know, the left and the right, it's an enormous number. From the left, you've had, you know, Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, all called populist. You know, and the right, there's the People's Party in Denmark, Freedom Party in Austria, the Front National in France, Jean-Luc Mélenchon on the left in France, sorry, as well, the Swiss People's Party, Progress Party in Norway, Geert Wilders' Freedom Party in the Netherlands, UKIP in Britain, you know, and in Australia, Pauline Hanson, Nick Xenophon, but, you know, there's a huge number. And generally, this use of populism is as a term of abuse. It's something, you know, to be watched out for. So already in 2010, you know, then European Union President Herman Van Rompuy called populism the greatest danger in Europe. So what actually is it? The most basic definition of populism is a political movement which appeals to the rights and power of the people against a group of corrupt elites. And we can already see that there's already a very broad application you can have that obscures, you know, the actual social content of political movements. So in an article from 2015, US magazine The New Yorker was comparing Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, both as populists, and said, you know, they're what makes them populist, gave a list of groups that could be targeted, and it was Mexicans, billionaires, Jews, politicians. So just gliding over the difference between racism and hatred of the rich. You know, however, you know, its usage gets even broader than this. So the Financial Review and The Australian have both recently published a bunch of articles calling Bill Shorten a populist, basically for criticising the coalition government. You can find articles calling almost every US president of the 20th and 21st century a populist as well. So a term that can be applied so broadly, you know, obviously I think we have to be, you know, a bit wary of that. And I think the origins of this wider usage in mid-20th century US political theory are actually instructive for understanding how the term is used today. So in the United States, populism had previously been used only as a descriptive term for a quite specific political movement, the People's Party, nicknamed the Populists. So in the 1890s, in the Midwest and in the South, the People's Party represented a powerful movement against corporate power that demanded solutions to economic turmoil and rampant inequality. Their description as populists didn't carry the same negative connotations as today. They were a coalition of class forces, and they appealed to various sections of the population, both small farmers and wage workers. So grain and cotton farmers, coal miners and railway workers made up its biggest constituencies, but the party also attracted a spectrum of middle-class activists. And in contrast to the people were the elites. The populists believed that corporations held undue influence over elections, the halls of government and the courts. Their success in the early 1890s terrified East Coast capitalists. So in his private diaries, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, who would later become US president, wrote that the populists should be put up against the wall and shot, since their campaign was nothing less than an appeal to the torch. The party collapsed after the 1896 presidential election, where instead of running its own candidate, it endorsed a losing Democratic Party candidate. And while remnants of the organisation limped on for a few years, most populist activists either retired from politics, joined a major party, or followed Eugene Debs into his new Socialist Party. This isn't a talk on the 19th century US politics, about whom there's a lot more you could say, But for a set of liberal intellectuals in the 1950s, they became an important part of defining a new concept of populism. So between the two world wars, the word populist is barely used at all, except in reference to the specific US populist parties and also as a translation of the Russian Narodniks. However, a shift in usage occurs following World War II, and this usage is traceable to the works of liberal political theorist Richard Hofstadter and a group of social scientists he worked alongside. For Hofstadter, populism was part of a series of concepts he used in making a break from left-wing politics to become a defender of the establishment against both the left and the right. His reference point was a particular reading of the original populist movement in his 1955 work, The Age of Reform. Until the 1950s, the dominant trend was for progressive US historians to defend the populists as an American example of a radical and progressive movement fighting against corporate capitalism. In Hofstadter's account, however, the populists were a reactionary movement, looking backwards to a lost agrarian Eden and mobilised around anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, blaming the US's economic problems on Jewish bankers. In this, Hofstadter saw the populists as the predecessor of Cold War anti-communists and right-wingers like Joe McCarthy and the John Birch Society. So as another 1950s social theorist, Daniel Bell, put it, the radical right of the early 1960s is in no way different from the populists of the 1890s, who for years traded successfully on such simple formulas as Wall Street, international bankers, and the trusts. These anti-populist theorists went beyond the most basic definition of populism as the people versus the elites to suggest a particular way populists utilised popular will. Hofstadter's colleague Edward Shields wrote in 1956, populism proclaims that the will of the people as such is supreme over every other standard, over the standards of traditional institutions, over the autonomy of institutions, and over the will of other strata. Populism identifies the will of the people with justice and morality. So according to these liberal theorists, it isn't just that populists speak in the name of the people, but that anyone who disagrees with them is by definition outside of the people and therefore should be excluded from rights. This exclusion may be justified on a racist basis or on a conspiratorial basis that opposition is being mobilised by foreign agents, but either way, it justifies exclusion, and this exclusion justifies authoritarian repression of these non-people. And alongside this, alongside the implication of the shared basis of both these left and right populists, is the further thesis that they easily transform into their supposed opposites. The classic story used of this supposed volatility, evidence of this supposed volatility, is that of Thomas Watson, a US populist who ended his career as a right-wing demagogue attacking immigrants. So, it's worth going to his story a bit. The son of a southern slave owner, ruined by the Civil War, Watson somewhat surprisingly ended up embracing liberal politics on racism in the 1890s. So he opposed lynch laws, supported black voting rights, and one time even organised masses of his supporters to physically defend a black populist preacher who was being threatened with violence by Southern Democrats in 1892. After the collapse of the populists, however, Watson increasingly came to embrace racist politics. So by the 1910s, he was attacking Jewish billionaires, supporting the disenfranchisement of black voters in southern states, and most notoriously, he used his magazine to organise the lynching of a Jewish factory superintendent, Leo Frank. So his story is still a reference point in the same 2015 New Yorker article I mentioned earlier on Sanders and Trump. The story of Thomas Watson is gone into in some detail, and this leads the New Yorker author to the conclusion on the basic similarity between left and right. You know, that's the volatile nature of populism, he writes. It can ignite reform or reaction, idealism or scapegoating. Now, this is obviously a pretty dramatic political transformation, but the idea that Watson's particular political trajectory can be used as a stand-in for the entire populist movement is pretty suspect, and the idea that it captures some significant truths about something called populism today, especially so. As previously mentioned, a large number of Socialist Party activists had their start in the populists. And, you know, unlike the populists, the SP, and especially their left, actually had a class analysis of society and politics which clearly saw workers and capitalists as antagonistic forces. So one of their most important leaders on the left, and the SP's regular presidential candidate, Eugene Debs, wrote in his 1900 election manifesto that the Republican platform is a self-congratulation of the dominant capitalist class. Prosperity galore, give us 4 years more. The Democratic platform is the wail and cry of the perishing middle classes, calamity without end. The Social Democratic platform is an indictment of the capitalist system. It is the call to class consciousness and political action of the exploited working class, and it is a ringing declaration in favour of collective ownership of all the means of production and distribution as the clarion voice of economic freedom. So that's the left of the SP. The right of the SP emphasised the winning of reforms above the class struggle and could attract some of those, you know, vaguer elements, but even they had their basis in organisations of the working class, like trade unions. None of this is the reactionary movement supposedly contained in embryo within the Populist Party. So while these very different political trajectories of people like, you know, Thomas Watson and Eugene Debs point to the difference between a party like the Socialist Party with a, you know, clear class analysis and a cross-class movement, you know, like the original populists, which could bring together quite diverse social forces and political formations, it is also important to note that a left-wing trajectory was far more common than the sort of dramatic jag to the right undergone by Watson. The idea that the US populists were the forerunners of the Cold War anti-communists and racists, which is Hofstadter's thesis, also doesn't hold up to scrutiny. So anti-Semitism, for example, was far less common amongst populists than it was amongst all of their political opponents, and was also challenged by populist activists, including those who would later join European Jews in the American Socialist Party later in their political career. You know, the idea that there was also a crossover between the social base of 1890s populism and 1950s McCarthyism is also empirically bunk. So Hofstadter blamed the rise of Joseph McCarthy on the fact that in a populistic culture like ours, he wrote, which seems to lack a responsible elite with political and moral autonomy, it is possible to exploit the widest current of public sentiment for private purposes. So this is a liberalism, obviously, which is disdainful of the mass of the population, you know, and, you know, explicitly so. In the 1950s, Hofstadter warned against liberal intellectuals' tendency to sentimentalise the folk, and other American liberal intellectuals of the time wrote of their greater affinity to Wall Street than their former allies, the farmers and the lower classes of the city. And today it is still popular, I think, amongst the liberal press, to suggest that the problem today is too much democracy and any mass movement to change society is likely to stir up the sort of discontent that will lead to reactionary outcomes. But far from being fueled by a mass base, McCarthy's main support was from the traditional Republican Party base of business owners. And McCarthy's Reds Under the Beds hysteria was not driven by popular sentiment, but was part of a campaign driven by the elites. You know, going back to President Harry Truman and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, who used the hysteria as part of a campaign against not only the left, but mass movements of the oppressed, as well as the American trade union movement. So bogged down by empirical flaws, Hofstadter's theory was basically out of academic fashion amongst historians of the populace by the late 1960s. And by the time of his death in 1970, even Hofstadter had conceded that his description of the populace bared little relation to historical reality. The term, however, continued to find broader usage in the social sciences. From the 1960s onwards, populism began to be applied to a whole series of international political phenomena, from historical fascism to authoritarian parties and regimes in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, as well as to, newly developing right-wing parties in Western Europe. So, you know, at a 1967 conference at the London School of Economics called To Define Populism, even Hofstadter was reportedly taken aback at the, you know, very wide range of phenomena being discussed, commenting that he had only thought that they would look at the American and Russian varieties. So, yeah, it sort of enters in the 60s and 70s into widespread usage in political science. The term begins to be widely used in journalism and in public debates in Europe from the mid-1980s into the 1990s. So it was used as a term of abuse in political debates, usually at figures outside of the political mainstream. And yeah, in recent years, this usage has continued. There's been the development of a whole academic industry continuing in this line of populism studies. And yeah, continuing basically on the line that's developed by these social theorists in the 50s and 60s. And this isn't because of some enduring influence of, you know, Hofstadter or his colleagues over, you know, the liberal intelligentsia. Instead, these modern liberal theorists find populism, the concept, useful for the same reasons that they did. You know, Hofstadter and his colleagues were breaking from the leftism of their youth and articulating a defence of the political establishment. So the theory of populism fits very well with a contemporary liberal centre attempting to understand the crisis it is going through, understand the threats that it faces from both the left and the right, and, you know, form tactics and strategies to deal with them. So some liberal theorists have followed directly on from Hofstadter's arguments. So in the United States, Michael Kazin's 1998 History of American Populism, The Populist Persuasion, traces a continuity from the 1890s populist through to McCarthyism, through to the you know, US Republican right of the 90s. You know, unlike Hofstadter, he doesn't consider the original populists to be out-and-out reactionaries. You know, he thinks there was a shift in populism from the left to the right over the 20th century. But he thinks that this shift is possible because, you know, of a, in populist language, in his account, you can easily substitute Jews for money power. And, you know, the whole theoretical edifice has been established around the basic idea that there is some significant thing in common with the parties to the left and to the right of the mainstream. So the way of establishing this commonality in modern popular studies, there's two main ways of doing this. The first is by analysing populism not as a political ideology, but instead as a political logic, something that can be adopted as a strategy by either the left or the right. And the second is to say that populism is a political ideology. It does come with particular ideas attached to it, but it's what they call a thin ideology that covers only a very small amount of the political agenda and needs to be attached to some thick ideology like socialism or nationalism. And, you know, there are some blurred lines between these different approaches. You know, so the earlier mentioned writer Michael Kazin uses a framework which adopts bits of both, but I think they're worth separating out as they usually vary on the question of whether they think populism is always something negative. So the first approach of defining populism as a logic is most associated with the post-Marxist theorists Chantal Mouffe and Ernesto Laclau. So this approach tends to have a far more positive argument for the adoption of populism as a strategy by the left. So Laclau and Mouffe's political work began in the 1980s as an attack on the Marxist explanations of the operation of capitalism and the centering of the working class in political strategy. So bourgeois society, in their view, was far too complex to be captured by the supposedly simplistic theories of Marxism or any other rationalist theory for that matter. So any theory that suggests that there's a grand narrative of society, you know, based on the existence of material or social factors, you know, any theory like that can be dismissed as essentially, you know, reductionist. Instead of the grand narratives these theoretical frameworks provided, what they thought was needed are political theories which could instead account for the shifting and indeterminate nature of politics. So a lot of their early work was highly abstract, but Laclau's 2005 book on populist reason attempted to provide a slightly more fleshed out depiction of what they think this open politics would look like, and populism was the word he used to define it. So Laclau analysed populism as a form of political logic that operates as so. It sets up a conflict between a people and an elite that is defined by specific kinds of demands that are unsatisfiable by the elites. So a party utilising this logic would ideally hope to use this conflict to provoke a rupture in society, which could then enable it to capture the state, which it would use to bring about a transformation of society in the interests of the people. So these people and elite are not preordained, but would themselves be constructed on the basis of the populist demands. So the concrete content of these political demands is less important than their ability to unite this new people. So ideally these demands can actually operate as what they call an empty signifier, so something that can be filled in with different meanings by a variety of different classes or sections of society. So the goal of the left then becomes to find the demands and the language which can most successfully unite, the largest number of disparate groups. So Laclau gives us an example, the demand of solidarity in Poland for workers' rights in the early 1980s. He argues that this wasn't important as a working class demand, but actually just for its ability to stand in for larger demands for national independence that neither, the Polish communist government nor the Soviet Union was prepared to grant, and that could, provoke a rupture in society. So I think, this is pretty ridiculous. Like, it's a framework that sucks the class politics even out of a working class uprising. It reduces everything in politics, even, quite concrete specific demands, to just being sort of glittering generality that we're used to hearing, politicians use when they use terms like hope, change, or freedom. You can just sort of fill it in with whatever meaning you want. And I think, that this approach basically flows from, the post-Marxist, rejection of the existence of stable classes and social categories of any kinds. And I think this approach can lead to some, serious political problems. So, while this populism, Marxism does counterpose, a mass of people to an elite, these are not considered in Laclau's theory as a fundamental antagonism of capitalism. Instead, their opposition is just established by the populist demands themselves. So without an understanding, though, of workers and capitalists as opposed classes, the need for class organisation and class independence is also lost. And this can lead to some pretty dubious attempts to form political coalitions. With the left and right divide erased, Laclau and Mouffe's left populism makes it a priority to build coalitions, including voters whose orientation may be fundamentally, towards the right. And an example of where this leads in practice can be seen with the political proposals of Iñigo Errejón, the founding political secretary and chief secretary of Podemos, who has since his 2017 split with Pablo Iglesias been, the ideological head of the right wing within the party. So amongst all of Podemos, Errejón has the most explicitly embraced and defended Laclau and Mouffe's theories of left populism. He actually co-wrote a book with Chantal Mouffe in 2016. And for him, left populism means a project aimed mainly at the middle classes. So by using post-class rhetoric, you can de-emphasise radical politics, unposition yourself from the left and appeal to the amorphous groupings of voters in the middle who are not yet convinced that a party like Podemos, you know, is trustworthy enough to run the Spanish state. So having ditched class politics and a left-right axis, this approach fails to grasp how the deepening of a left-wing approach could actually mobilise and win over people, as we've seen, for example, with Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. Instead, it arrives through Laclau's populist logic at the same dead-end strategy that centre-left parties have actually chased to oblivion globally, of, you know, chasing the centre ground to an increasingly small share of the vote. So that's the, yeah, sort of political logic theorist of populism. The other side is the description of populism as a thin ideology. So this account was you know, most developed by a Dutch political scientist, Cas Mulder, in the early 2000s. And Mulder has become the go-to populism expert for publications like The Guardian. So he's published a bunch of other popular books on the topic and influenced current theorists. But yeah, if these theorists of populism tend to emphasise the negatives of populism, and you know, they're the ones who write articles in The Guardian suggesting strategies for liberal democracy to fight back against populism. So one such political scientist and Guardian commentator, Jan Werner Müller, describes, you know, this thin ideology that populism has as follows. So the core claim of populism is it's a moralised form of anti-pluralism. Populism requires a pars pro toto argument and claim to exclusive representation, with both understood in a moral as opposed to empirical sense. There can be no populism, in other words, without someone speaking in the name of the people as a whole. So, you know, in other words, yeah, populism, similar to earlier, like anyone who disagrees with it is excluded, which means that populism is inherently anti-democratic, anti-pluralist, moralistic, and extremely dangerous. So, you know, a populist is someone who says that the whole people support them, but, you know, since no politician has ever been universally popular, that means that, yeah, populists deal very badly, in this account, with the issue of dissent. And, you know, because they're by their own definition popular, anyone who is in opposition, you know, is outside of the people, therefore not fully human, therefore justified in being repressed. And so, yeah, they see it as a particularly dangerous kind of ideology, especially, you know, once it wins political power. You know, it might be able to serve a role in opposition of raising demands that are outside the mainstream, but once in political power, you know, it quickly would tend towards authoritarianism. And so for them, the key political question then becomes, how do we defend the establishment from populist threats? How do we stop populists from getting into power? So, you know, one piece of evidence that's from this week of, you know, the absolute bankruptcy of this kind of approach comes from an article that Cas Mulder has published in The Guardian this Wednesday. If people have seen, he's actually advocating an electoral alliance with the fascist Jobbik in Hungary against Orbán as a supposed defence of liberal democracy. The idea being that by strengthening the fascists, they can prevent Orbán from winning further power and, yeah, therefore doing away with liberal democracy. So the article concludes as follows. Liberals have a choice between remaining pure and facing the certainty of an illiberal state, or dirtying their hands and at least fight for a liberal democratic future. So there are less than 2 weeks left. The clock is ticking. So there's nothing here about challenging any of the right-wing or racist policies of any party. You know, there's nothing, you know, in, yeah, this decrepit sort of liberalism, you know, other than basically dicking about with different far-right parties in, you know, some attempt to magically summon up another day of, yeah, liberal democracy. So I think, yeah, the main problem, though, with this approach is the same in most sort of attempts to describe populism. Is that it tries to find some common concept underlying all populists, whether of the left or the right. And to do this, there has to be a serious distortion of the social content between political parties whose similarity can usually be reduced to slight similarities in rhetoric, if that. So, key to this is that same old idea that there is, you know, a similarity in the social base of parties of the left and of the right, that they're somehow mirror images of each other, and that there's a volatility to populist politics that enables one to easily pass from one to the other. So, you know, this is a smear which is commonly used against left-wing figures, you know, like Bernie Sanders, Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France, and Jeremy Corbyn, that they're somehow similar to, you know, Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen. So, you know, in the wake of the 2017 UK general election, conservative publication The Spectator published an article entitled Corbyn Copy, Why Jeremy and Trump Are Almost the Same. And, yeah, if you want to look it up, they've even done a great Photoshop of Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump's faces, like, blurring into each other, so you can see how they have the same face. And The Guardian regularly attacks parties of the left and the right with the same broad brush. So one editorial byline, which I found, declared as follows. In Europe's north, insurgent populist parties blame socialism. In the south, they blame capitalism, but they all blame foreigners, and that must be wrong and dangerous. And what they mean by foreigners in the case of southern Europe, they mean, like, yeah, Greece and Spain seeing the EU as actually, yeah, playing a role in the austerity in those countries, and that somehow, yeah, equivalent to just migrant bashing or Islamophobia. So, again, in The Guardian, we can read that Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France is awkwardly in tune with Le Pen, is their words, and that his refusal to swiftly endorse Macron was shocking and shabby, and that the hard left's hesitation to call out a fascist leaves a bitter taste. Well, I think this completely distorts the relationship between the left, the centre and the right. It is not, for instance, the hard left which has hesitated to call out fascists. Not only is the sensible centre, you know, the part of society which regularly attacks anti-fascists for being, you know, just as bad as fascists, it's the establishment parties of the centre-left and centre-right which have been responsible for decades of Islamophobia, refugee and migrant bashing, and racist law and order campaigns, which have become, the breeding ground for fascist movements and a lot of the basis for the sort of right-wing politics we see today. And this is because the embrace that they have of neoliberalism has given them little other politics to offer people than the politics of fear, division and distraction. And it's actually, yeah, the left which offers an alternative to this. But the reason that these populist theorists at all can get away with this distortion, can get away with conflating left and right, is that, as the crisis of neoliberalism has sharpened, there is obviously polarisation to both the left and the right. So globally, there's been a pattern of, increasing political polarisation, based on several factors. So there's been the weakness of the recovery since the, 2008 financial crisis for the majority of workers, rising levels of inequality, obscene extremes of poverty and wealth, a crisis of the political parties of neoliberalism and their subsequent delegitimization of these mainstream parties of, the right, centre-right, liberal, and the sort of vague social democratic kind of mainstream that have all presided over similar sort of policies for decades. But just because in this crisis there's a polarisation to both the left and the right doesn't mean that there will be anything in common between the politics or the supporters of new parties or movements that develop in response to the mainstream. So contrary, for example, to liberal hysteria, at most 10% of Sanders and Mélenchon voters went on to vote for Trump or Le Pen, and that's because, their base is different. So while Trump can win over, some sections of the working class, his support comes from the traditional right. So, while he's often described as a working class phenomenon, the core of his support is similar to that of the Tea Parties in its older, white, suburban middle classes, and the non-college educated backers are concentrated amongst small business people and managerial employees. So Trump didn't ride a surge in working class enthusiasm, but actually it was a collapse in it. So it wasn't a surge in Trump votes, it's actually that the Democratic support in the Rust Belt amongst the working class collapsed, as large numbers of traditional Democrat voters stayed home or to a lesser extent voted for a third party. So it wasn't that, you know, Trump flipped working class votes, it's that Democrats lost them. So Sanders voters in the primary were far more likely to not vote in the general election than to vote for Trump. And this not voting doesn't come from an affinity to Trump, but a rightful opposition to Clinton and the Democrats, especially their role in crushing Sanders' left-wing alternative. So the political, as well as their base, the political solutions offered to the crisis by the left and the far right are also completely different. So the blood and nation politics offered by the right are in complete contrast to the social democratic proposals to redistribute wealth and fund social services. And in fact, right-wing politics share far more with the neoliberal response to the crisis than the left. It's the neoliberal parties, you know, centre-left and centre-right in France that have presided over, you know, decades of Islamophobia, you know, not the left, and it was the centre-left there that actually, yeah, introduced the state of emergency and authoritarianism, John-Louis Mélenchon. But by reframing politics from left versus right to populist versus the centre, defenders of the establishment are able to attack the left and then put pressure on them to basically fold in behind establishment parties as the only defence against the right. They also, as mentioned, obscures the very role that these establishment parties then played in actually generating both the racism and the economic misery, which can kind of fuel the far right. So we shouldn't succumb to that pressure. Both the establishment centre and the insurgent far right have to be opposed, and a capitulation to the former means that a genuine left alternative will never be built. The use of populism as a catch-all term for new phenomena on the left and right should be roundly rejected. Another reason, just to start finish off around that, is that as well as the usage of this term populism by liberals, I think the wider usage of the term populism has also been extremely helpful for various actual fascist and far-right parties in rebranding themselves. So in the early 1980s, after, you know, the socialist parties turned to austerity in 1983, the Front National in France, you know, a fascist party, had their first real electoral success. They won 11% in the European elections and 10 seats in 1984. So in an article from later in that year, French political scientist and historian Pierre-André Taguieff used the term national populism for the first time to describe this new, you know, successful party, and the term was quickly picked up by the French media. And, you know, while this started off as a term of abuse, it was soon actually embraced by the Front National as a way of moving away from their association with the traditional terms of fascism and far right. So in 1987, you had Jean-Pierre Stebouy, a party veteran, admitting that he could completely recognise himself in the phrase national populism. "I retake it with pride," he said. "In national populism, there are two words, people and nation, which, in my opinion, are which are linked, and to which I am profoundly, viscerally attached. National populism carries its name with pride. It is a profoundly, authentically popular phenomenon." And in the 2017 French election, Marine Le Pen once again claimed the word. So she said, "What's populism? If it's someone who wants to defend government of the people, by the people, and for the people, then yes, I am a populist." The practice of vile authoritarian bigots terming themselves populist to give a veneer of democratic concern to their movement has spread. So we've seen, Stephen Bannon has been touring Europe recently, describing himself as a fire-breathing populist, talking about setting up like a populist international across America and Europe. He actually uses the term to dismiss accusations of fascist sympathising. So he says, "This is all theoretical bullshit. I don't know. Populism, fascism, who cares? It's a media smear of the populist movement." So here you can see how, this excessive usage of populist that, talked about earlier in the talk actually dovetails really nicely both with liberals who are keen to not call a fascist a fascist, And then, yeah, fascists who are looking to not be called fascists and trying to detoxify. And also, linked in with this is this whole thing of basically blaming the masses and not the elite for sort of racism and reactionary politics. And I think, yeah, for all these reasons, we have to, be extremely critical of this excessive use of the term. It's not, even when there's been, large votes for figures like Le Pen or Trump, it's not, the masses, organisers and masses that are actually doing this. This is a result, I think, of basically the inability of the mass of ordinary people to intervene into politics. A decade of, disorganisation of their parties and their unions that have sort of, left a space basically for the right to fill in as the only alternative to the establishment. So I think, in response to this, we have to reject both what the left populist kind of Laclau logic suggests, that we need to build, these sort of vague, coalitions to fight the right. We have to also reject what those, liberal theorists who suggest we just have to go back to the very establishment that has produced this problem. I think instead, we need to build a left which rejects, the choice between the different wings of capitalism. And I think in regards to populism, we need much better and sharper concepts to explain the crisis of today. I think we should reject the narrative that populism unites either the politics or the supporters of the left and the right. We should reject the idea that populism poses a special threat to society that makes the establishment worth defending. So, yeah.